Burton and Ms. Nyberg. The last case for argument is United States versus Gastelum, and this is the one by speakerphone. So is Mr. Hernandez on the phone? Okay, so Mr. Hernandez, we're ready for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Arturo Hernandez for the record on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Gastelum. In this matter, Your Honor, this case is based on three arguments. The first one that I will address briefly is the speedy trial rights violation and the prejudice caused by the government. In this case, it's undisputed that there was an extension of time from 425 to 523, and the court did not on the record explain the exclusion of time, but rather on a, by court order, without the presence of anyone in the courtroom, the record indicates on 505 of 06, he extended excludable time, which would make it a 12-day delay after the 70-day requirement of the Speedy Trial Rights Act. On the other hand, the government argues that maybe that was arguably done by the court to justify one thing or another, but there's no specific exclusion of time on the record. It was just done retroactively. We argue that the Speedy Trial Rights does not allow for a non-proton exclusion. So we feel that the court improperly excluded that time. I understand the government is arguing that maybe only 2 days or maybe 1 day. Well, this is a litmus test. It's either or a delay or not, by 1 day or 2 days or 12 days. We feel that in this case the delay was unjustifiable and that the court should remand this case for a violation of the speedy trial right and order that it be dismissed with prejudice. The defendant appellant had extended his case because on the eve of a plea agreement, he had doubt about his attorney that was retained out of Tucson, Arizona. He then hired me. We had filed some motions, and the case was extended for trial preparation. But that's not the point. The lower court intended to justify the violation of the speedy trial right because the court indicates was frustrated because the defendant apparently was manipulating the system by hiring different lawyers and different numerous. It was only one. It was only one change of attorneys in the whole case. So I think the record is clear that this case should be remanded and the court, lower court, should be ordered that it be with prejudice.
Why should it be dismissed with prejudice if you're right?
I think that it's clear from the record that the substantial delay eroded all, as we argued in the points and authorities, we eroded the stamina, the forte of the mental forte of the defendant, and
the mental what? I didn't
mental
hear.
Forte.
Well,
he's
mental what? I didn't hear your word.
Mental forte. What I'm trying to say, Your Honor, is that his mind.
I don't know what's the word after mental. I can't understand you.
The forceful of his mental strength is eroded by the delay in this case. The witnesses clearly indicated that by Officer Rowley's letter from the government indicating that he had lapsed memory and he could not recall exactly any longer what exactly my client had said to him or to her at the time of the arrest, whether or not he had lived in Illinois, etc. So the delay caused the witness's lapse of memory. That's a substantial prejudice. And the loss of resources, of the limited resources of the defendant by the delay of the government trial would be sufficient to indicate that this is a case that should be dismissed with prejudice. I will go on to the next, the last one would be the prosecutorial misconduct. That was a clear violation of the defendant's right not to present any evidence. The burden shifted to him on closing argument, when the government clearly indicated that he had not presented any evidence to indicate there was any legitimate purposes of his visit to Illinois. The misconduct is clearly intentional, because after the court attempted to somehow justify and give the answer to the prosecution by saying it was a slip of the tongue, and I don't think it was intentional, they responded on the record by saying that she had been an attorney, a U.S. attorney, in Texas, and there was case law in the Fifth Circuit that would allow her to do this sort of argument. The court responded, there's dozens of cases that fly against your argument here in the Seventh Circuit. But I think the point is that she clearly intended to say what she said. It was not a slip of the tongue.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Mr. Hernandez. Your time has expired.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Hammerman?
Good morning, Your Honors. Joel Hammerman on behalf of the United States. May it please the Court. Mr. Hernandez has begun by pointing out a specific period of time that he says was improperly excluded. In particular, it's addressed in the government's brief in footnote 15. That from April 25th to May 5th, there was a time that nothing in the court docket is there shown that time was going to be excluded. On April 25th, that was the date that it was actually 2 days or a day before the defendant had stated he was going to enter a plea of guilt in the case. Mr. Hernandez appeared in the case. A few days later, the court realized that it wasn't excluding time, and of course that was an appropriate thing to do because the date for the change of plea had been set shortly before time would have excluded, but now the defendant had new counsel. The new counsel had requested time to familiarize himself with the case, and the court entered the order on that day. Whether the court actually addressed that in that April 25th hearing is unknown because that particular transcript was not included in the record on appeal. But whether that 10 days was included or not is immaterial because, as set forth in the government's brief, there are two periods of time that the defendant simply does not address. And that is that he includes in his time, as included under the Speedy Trial Act, the time from the date of the indictment rather from the date of the arraignment. As set forth in our brief, the time that started clicking, if you will, on the Speedy Trial Act is from the date of the arraignment in this case, because it is the first time the defendant appeared in connection with the charges with which he was eventually prosecuted. In addition, there is a period of time in February of 2006, beginning on February 15th of 2006, where the judge allowed both parties 20 days in which to file pretrial motions or Rule 404B motion for the government, if it wanted to file such a motion. The government said it was going to let the clock tick during that period of time. However, the statute is clear that that period of time where the parties have time to file pretrial motions, as interpreted by this court in Tibble and Montoya, that period of time should be excluded under the Speedy Trial Act. The defendant includes it. It should be excluded. Either one of those provisions takes this 10 days that he has now addressed to Your Honors this morning, it makes it irrelevant. With respect to the prosecutorial misconduct claim, the idea that because the words came out of her mouth, it could not have been a slip of the tongue, the court found that it was a slip of the tongue, and a slip of the tongue can be one of various things. In this case, it's clear that counsel for the government had a misunderstanding of when the particular argument of, in a sense, a missing witness could be made. She made the argument, and she was quickly slip of the tongue was quickly addressed by the court.
That's not a proper use of the term slip of the tongue. Slip of the tongue is just a misspeaking, you mispronounce a word, you do something, a garble like that. It's not a mistake. It's not a synonym for mistake. Otherwise, you'd say any improper statement made in the trial, that's just a slip of the tongue. Right? Prosecutor says, well, the defendant didn't testify, so he must be guilty. If he weren't guilty, he'd get up here and, you know, he'd testify under oath. Well, you can't say that's a slip of the tongue.
I think that's how
the person has a deep misunderstanding of the law. A slip of the tongue, a slip of the brain, maybe.
And maybe that's what the judge meant. I mean, what's most important here, though, is that it wasn't done.
The tongue, if he didn't mean it.
I believe that, I mean, the statement came out of her mouth. It was clear that that was what she intended to say. You're right, Your Honor. It wasn't, she just mispronounced a word. But there was no malicious intent. But what's more important, too, is if you look at the standards that are set.
I understand what malicious intent is. What if U.S. attorney instructs assistant U.S. attorneys, in closing argument, you should always say, if the defendant has not testified, that the jury should infer that he's guilty. An honest person would give his side of the story, right? Right? And then all the U.S. assistant U.S. attorneys, they would say this in the closing argument. The judge would say that's improper. And say, well, that's what I honestly believe that because that's what my boss has told me. It's not exculpatory, surely.
It was not done with malicious intent. And the reason, and
my example is no malicious intent, right?
They're
just miseducated, misinstructed by their superiors.
Which then leads, I think,
I know what it leads to. I mean, clearly in that case, that's a violation of the Fifth Amendment.
Correct. But in this case,
what's different about this case?
What makes this case different is if you look then at the standards for assessing what this violation, how this violation should be addressed, and that is the nature of the violation. It's not as egregious as the example you just gave, Your Honor, and it wasn't as intentional. If it was intentional, that would only be one factor. There were other factors, which are the adequacy of
the law is not a very good defense for a U.S. attorney.
I can't disagree with that, but if you look at then all of the factors for addressing how to deal with that mistake, that violation, you look at the nature of it.
Say it's a trivial violation, it's a harmless error. I understand that. I don't understand any of this stuff about slip of the tongue, honest mistake, all that stuff. That just complicates the case.
I see that my time is up.
Okay, well, thank you. And Mr. Hernandez, your time had expired, but do you have anything further? You can have a minute. So.
Just to conclude, Your Honor, the evidence was clear that after the judge attempted to give her some kind of an excusable answer, she failed to grasp the indication by the court, and instead she said, no, it was not. It was not a mistake. I have laws that I have case law from the Fifth Circuit where I have practiced. She was a well-experienced attorney. And she cited intimated some case law from the Fifth Circuit. The court clearly told her there's dozens of cases that fly against your argument. So it was not a slip of the tongue. It was not something inadvertent. It was a deliberate attempt to implicate my client by saying that there was no evidence at all whatsoever on the record that he was here on vacation. So obviously he had to be there for a legal purpose. I would submit it, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Hernandez and Mr. Hammerman. And the court will be in recess until 9:30.